I'm not sure where it came from, but it's aided by another molecule, which are the carotenoids. So the chlorophylls pick up in the blue and the red region of the spectrum, and then they're also aided in the thalcoid membrane by carotenoids, which again have a long hydrocarbon chain and two ring structures, and they fill in the sort of green part of the spectrum. Okay, so what I really want to do is use this as a model for the other kinds of photon detectors that we'll be talking about. I mean, this is all, here we're getting with the, we're harvesting photons to provide energy for metabolism, for synthesis of organic compounds. The other obvious important thing that we do with photon detection is we use it in sensory systems. And that's not surprising if you think about it. I mean, light travels at the ultimate speed limit. It can be refracted to form images, and from images you can get information about present and impending events. So it's not surprising that every single animal has some kind of photon detector. And the general scheme that we've seen here is that there's a detector, there's an amplifier, and there's a readout. Now for the sensory rhodopsins, for the sensory detectors in animals, they all use the same detector molecule, and that's derived from the carotenoid, basically this thing cut in half. And that's a retinal. So retinal has a ring structure and a 9-carbon side chain that normally is existing in a cis configuration. So this would be 11 cis retinal. The absorption of a photon then just straightens the side chain, turning it into all trans. So all the animal visual pigments use retinal as their detector. It's present in membrane proteins, and these are a special class of membrane proteins that have 7 transmembrane segments. And retinal sits somewhere in the middle of this protein. And this is often called rhodopsin. There are also other visual pigments that are not rhodopsin, like the cone visual pigments. And the way rhodopsin works is that when the retinal absorbs a photon, it goes from this bent configuration to a straight configuration. So it becomes 11 cis, or all trans, I mean. The side chain straightens out. That causes the molecule to undergo a number of sort of conformational changes. This occurs probably at the limit of conformational changes. It takes about 10 femtoseconds for this cis-trans isomerization. Then the molecule itself goes through a number of dark reactions that occur in the dark, and it changes the surface structure on the inside of the molecule. So now it looks something like that, maybe. And that occurs on a much slower time scale. This takes on the order of milliseconds. So the detector then has gone, light has switched our detector into an activated state, which we'll refer to as RH. So now the membranes that contain this are like the membrane in the chloroplast in that they're packed with this kind of detector. And there are two different strategies for doing this. One is that animals decided to make their photoreceptors out of microvilli, which are things in the gut and other places that are used to increase surface area. So they derived photoreceptors from microvilli. The other strategy was to derive photoreceptors also from cilia, from epithelial cells, but these would be ciliated cells. I can draw a picture. I don't think they do. There's bacterial rhodopsin, which is found is again and found in archaebacteria, and that's a 7 transmembrane protein, and its chromophore is retinal. Yeah, it's vitamin A aldehyde. So. That's why, you know, have to take your vitamin A. Eat carrots. Well, carrots are a source of carotenoids. I guess you can synthesize retinol. That's right, yeah. But anyway, the bacterial rhodopsin is found in bacteria, but it has the sequence has very little similarity to the other G protein coupled receptors, but it's a 7 transmembrane spanning receptor, and it uses retinal. It goes backwards. Light takes the retinal from an all trans to 11 cis configuration, and it pumps. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
not a separate.
No, it's embedded in the protein, and the rhodopsin without the retinal is not light sensitive. It's just a membrane protein. So you need the retinal to make the there's a binding pocket for retinal
the retinal is made separately and covalently bonded to a somewhere.
That's right.
All right, because it's not coded for the same protein.
No. No. But anyway, to answer your question, Boris, I mean, I don't know that if you could correctly call this a precursor of a G-protein coupling. Yeah, I think they are. I think they first appear in the eukaryotes, where G-proteins are also. It pumps a proton, so the light-driven conversion of this from 11 cis to all trans, or from all trans to 11 cis, just the opposite, moves a proton. I think it goes out, so it creates a proton gradient, and then protons coming back in through down their gradient, that energy is coupled to synthesis of ATP, or in some other bacteria, movement of a flagellar motor. It's really sort of, both of those are rotary proteins, and they take the, as protons move into the cell, they move the molecules. What do they do for this? Oh yeah, I mean this is a huge area of endeavor or area of investigation. It's been crystallized to, I don't know, 2 angstrom resolutions. People argue about where the proton get. I mean, so they make mutants. You can take these things. You can put bacteria. Bacterial rhodopsin is now being made in biotech companies as detectors for using the proton gradient, again, as the detectors of various sorts. So they put it out in sheets of membrane. And
it's the same proton gradient as in the mitochondria.
Yeah, it's the same. Yeah, it's exactly the same idea. It's using the electrochemical gradient stored in a proton gradient to drive all kinds of things. And yeah, we use it in mitochondria to run ATP synthase. We also use it in all the synaptic vesicles to transport transmitters into vesicles. So using the proton gradient is a very common thing to do for intracellular organelles. If you want to move things back and forth across organelle membranes, it's often driven by the energy in the proton gradient. But you had asked, what do microvilli look like? In the gut, the epithelial cells give rise to these microvilli. They're packed with actin filaments. And they're mainly used to increase the surface area. So they provide an increase in the surface areas for absorption. The cilia don't contain actin. They contain microtubules. So if we did a cross section here, I've forgotten how many pairs there are. I think there are 9 pairs. 9 pairs of microtubules, and there's a central pair. This is typically a motile thing, the microtubules. Dynein is a motor that runs up and down on the microtubules, and it bends the cilia. So the ciliated epithelium are in respiratory tract, oviduct, ventricles in the brain, that sort of place. And these are all very ancient structures. And they were then made into photoreceptors.
You said the bacterial rhodopsin is not a precursor, but it is very closely related.
It's closely related topographically. But the sequence itself is not very similar to rhodopsin or any of the visual pigment. I think that's also quite different. I don't know why they came up with 7 transmembrane segments or retinal, but I think this was developed quite independently. But who knows? I don't know. But there's less similarity between bacterial rhodopsin and not necessarily, Boris. Most of the subunits in ion channels have the C and N terminals on the same side of the membrane. Here they're on the opposite side. So they're typically 6 transmembrane segments in the ion channel subunits. Some of them are different. And the ones that are different are actually the glutamate receptors. They're one of the few that have an odd number. And there it's 5, not 7. So I don't know. For the glutamate receptor, people attach an enormous significance to the fact that the N and C terminals are on opposite sides, because there's splice variation on both sides that fine-tune the sort of response properties of those receptors. I mean, I don't know why you would necessarily want them on the same or different sides. But
for the receptors, it kind of makes sense. That one terminal will go out.
Yeah.
The sample outside world, and the other one will be the sample
with it. Yeah. No, that's true. Those guys have a long tail, which gets modified in various ways. And this side is huge in the glutamate receptors, and includes the glutamate binding pocket. So, yeah, okay, yeah, all right.
How does this spatial arrangement of the transmembrane molecules attach
What's it look like?
Affect the, how does a special arrangement affect the functioning of the metal?
I'm not sure. If we were to look at this molecule, it's sort of a cigar-shaped molecule. And the helices are packed together. So if we took a cross-section, there'd be arranged something like that. They're sort of like a clamshell, actually. And that's sort of the topology. And by the activation of the chromophore from 11-cis to all trans causes one of these helices to move into the plane of the membrane. And that changes the surface structure on the intracellular side and allows it now, it reveals or allows it to interact with the next element in the cascade. Okay, so where we've gotten so far is that we have our detector, which we can sort of trace back to the chromophores that are used in photosynthesis. We have it packed into a membrane. We know that they're transmembrane proteins, so everything's happening on the membrane. And then the next step, and we've also seen that our receptor, in this case rhodopsin, goes from being active to being inactive, or going from light switches it from an inactive to an active form. So the next step involves the interaction of this with another protein called a G protein. And G proteins don't occur in bacteria, but they are found in just about all of the eukaryotes. They're heterotrimeric proteins, so they have three subunits, alpha, beta, and gamma. And the alpha subunit has a binding site for guanine nucleotides. So that's why they're called G proteins. They're guanine nucleotide binding proteins. And in the inactive state, this binding pocket contains GDP. When the receptor is activated and its surface changes, it can then bind to the inactive form of the G protein. And that binding opens this binding pocket. So now the pocket is open. And the GDP is free to dissociate. Now, this is a stable complex unless there's GTP around. So if the GDP comes out and GTP binds to the site, which is very likely because the concentration of GTP is greater than GDP. The binding then of GTP in the site dissociates this complex, so it sort of blows it apart. And what you have then is the activated rhodopsin or activated receptor plus the activated alpha subunit of the G protein plus the G beta gamma, which stay together. And you could think of that as being activated. So now this is holding on to GTP. And the activated receptor then is in the membrane and it can diffuse. So then it will serially activate a large number of these G proteins just by repeating this process, bumping into one, opening its binding pocket, allowing GTP to replace GDP, and making another activated G protein. Where's the arrow?
Yeah, I don't understand
what we are. So I was having this pocket open up, and then GTP going in place of GDP. And the binding of that then dissociates this thing into this. Oh, sorry. Yeah, so there's the missing arrow.
And what do they do then?
What do the G proteins do?
Yeah.
I'll get to that in just a minute. Let me just say that in photoreceptors, like in raw, in vertebrate rods, this happens about once per millisecond, and a single rhodopsin will turn on anywhere from 100 to 1,000 G proteins. So this is the first step of amplification in this process. Yeah, there is, but it's relatively low rate, and I'll come back to that in a little bit. It's a good point. Okay, so we have one stage of amplification, and then, in response to the question about what does the G protein do. It then interacts with an effector protein. And now I've written this as the alpha subunit interacting with the effector protein. But in many of these signaling cascades, the beta gamma subunit carries a signal. So it's in photoreceptors, that doesn't seem to be the case, but as we'll see in just a moment, this general scheme is used for detecting all kinds of things. So these effector proteins are typically enzymes. And they're, in particular, enzymes which control the concentration of second messengers. Again, typically, so these would be second messenger, typically either calcium or cyclic nucleotides. Cyclic AMP or cyclic GMP. Okay, let me erase things and redraw this. We don't have a proton gradient in the system. No, but we have a different ion gradient, which is also important, but it's not a proton gradient. So the generality would be that for photosynthesis we end up moving a charge across the membrane. And in that case we're storing up that charge gradient and using it as work. Here we're going to see that by moving a charge across the membrane we make an electrical signal that will do something for the cell or the system.
In one case, it's sort of light is just a source of energy, right?
It's
a transducer, and that's not amplifying the very best. It's not losing so much energy.
Well, but it does collect together the sort of energy from hundreds of chromophore, chlorophyll and carotenoid protein, so
it
doesn't amplify
it. Right?
That's right.
It is a source of energy in itself.
Right.
So whereas for the detection, it's really
okay.
Information processing device, right?
Right.
And the power supply elsewhere.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
What's the efficiency
of photosynthesis? I have no idea. I don't know. So you mean could you say how many photons does it take to move a single proton across the net? Yeah, I don't know. I think it's many though. I'm sure it's not one. But you have to ask someone who really knows about photosynthesis.
No, it's suggested, sorry.
Well, but yeah, it is in the record, but I'm saying it is pure God.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that if you get too far into the infrared, then you don't have enough energy in the photons. And if you get too far into the UV, you have too much. So I think it's sort of a balance between what is a reasonable energy source without causing, at the same time, causing a lot of free radical generation and damage. So. I guess the other reason is we wouldn't want, if we were sensitive into the infrared, then I don't know, we might give off all this light, right? We can only see the really hot people. And then, so this changes the concentration of a messenger. Somehow. Now this is the general scheme for G protein coupled signaling. And this is we're going to talk extensively about how this operates for the detection of light, but it's important to realize that these receptors have been modified to detect all kinds of things. And they're used for odor detection, so they're probably 1,000 different genes, or maybe even more, for just encoding the olfactory receptor proteins for different kinds of odorant molecules. We use them for detecting neurotransmitters, peptides, hormones, cannabinoids, endogenous opioids. So this is a really common signaling pathway, and it's all set up in the same way. You have a receptor that's designed to detect something, it gets activated, it turns on a G protein. The G protein turns on the effector, and then you get a change in a second messenger. And the second messenger, in most cases, causes a change in the cell's membrane potential. So you get a change in the electrical potential across the cell, which ultimately gets converted to a change in calcium. And then yeah, I'll show you how that I guess they don't always cause electrical changes, but typically they do, ultimately.
And then the electrical changes causes a change in
voltage. Oh, yeah. So it goes back again to a chemical change. And the change in calcium is important because for most sensory systems, they have to tell the next cell in the sensory pathway that they've seen the light. And the change in calcium is necessary for the release of transmitter. That would be calcium signaling, but in particular, then this triggers release of neurotransmitter.
Oh, I see.
And transfers the signal to the next cell. You know, all electrical signals are ultimately translated into a change in calcium. So all the electrical, in muscle, for example, the depolarization of the muscle causes a change in calcium, which triggers muscle contraction. And all the neurons and all the sensory receptors, the electrical change causes a change in calcium, which is the thing that drives the release of the neurotransmitter for the next cell.
How
that's right. He was right. All right, so now let's go back to the photoreceptors. The second messenger could be either, it could be calcium, or it could be a cyclic nucleotide, cyclic, let's say cyclic GMP. Now, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to leave this general scheme of G-protein coupled signaling and talk specifically about phototransduction.
There's less reaction in there. What happens to the calcium and the reactivated effector acts on it and so degrading it?
Typically it would increase it. And I'll show you an example of a system where we get an increase in calcium. And well, here it's upside down. I guess if I wrote it, forget it anyway. Nothing. That's all right. Okay, so now let's talk about the photoreception, phototransduction. And the invertebrates, which mostly make their photoreceptors out of microvilli, so the flies and things like that. But not all invertebrates do that, but in most cases, their microvillar photoreceptors. And they use, again, a rhodopsin that gets turned on by light through the cis-trans isomerization of retinal. That turns on a G-protein. Now, the G-proteins are enormously varied because there are like 23 different alpha subunits and probably roughly a similar number of beta and gamma subunits. So they can switch around and make up a huge diversity of G proteins. And one of them is called GQ. So 23 different alpha subunit genes, I think, have been identified. In a single species. In a single species, yeah. So you can get all different, there's a large variety of them, I guess. That's right, yeah. So we're going to talk about just two different kinds. One is this one they call GQ. And when it gets activated, and now I'm only going to talk about the alpha subunit, it turns on an enzyme called phospholipase C. And what phospholipase C does is, in the membrane are phospholipids that have a sugar group. So this is called PIP2, phosphatidylinositol bisphosphate. And there's a sugar group here, which is inositol trisphosphate, IP3. So when this enzyme acts on this membrane lipid, and it converts it into, I didn't mean to draw this like that, sorry. It's a membrane lipid, so it's just a fatty acid chain with probably a phosphate group out here and this sugar group on the inside. When this enzyme acts on this phospholipid, it leaves in the membrane a lipid, which is called diacylglycerol, DAG, and it releases IP3. IP3 then binds to IP3 receptors on the endoplasmic reticulum, which contains a high concentration of calcium. So when it binds to these receptors, calcium is released. So here we've released calcium. And then calcium can contribute to an electrical signal in a variety of ways. One is that it can cause, it can affect ion channels in the surface membrane, or it can turn on proteins that would open ion channels, that kind of thing. In the invertebrate world, though, the message apparently is continued by the phospholipid and not by IP3, not by calcium. And the phospholipid or its fatty acid metabolites then act on an ion channel called the TRP channel. And that opens this channel. And you get an influx of cations, sodium, calcium, kind of thing. And that generates a depolarization. Depolarization then spreads. So the way these receptors are built, there's a region that contain these modified microvilli. Then there's a cell body. And then there's a synaptic terminal. And this depolarization then spreads from out here where it was generated to the synaptic terminal. And that causes the release of a neurotransmitter, which is picked up by a second cell. And the signal then is transferred to the fly brain, basically. Calcium in this system is mostly thought to act as a feedback messenger that helps to shut this system off. But this is also an amplified system. A single rhodopsin activates many G proteins. And the G proteins, well, it's a one-for-one interaction with the effector enzyme. It's an enzyme. So the enzyme turns over many of these messenger molecules. So you get a second stage of amplification. You get the first one here, A1, and then you get the second one in the way it acts on the effector. So there are two stages of amplification. No, I mean, in invertebrates, it would be a different neurotransmitter than in us, for example.
I'm already moving, thinking about color.
Oh, color.
And I'm just wondering whether it's the location of the neuron, whether it's the neurotransmitter.
It's actually neither. It's I'll come back to that. So that's how the invertebrate does it. So now let's look at how the vertebrate does it. That was invertebrate. So that's like flies.
Are you implying that this IP3 signaling is sort of primary and it releases calcium and calcium then acts to open up the channels and get other stuff in?
In for that system I just drew, the real messenger is the lipid. That for the longest time in flies, right? They knew that rhodopsin activated phospholipase C. They knew that they got IP3 release, and they knew that they generated this lipid thing that just stayed in the membrane. And they also knew that there was a special ion channel that opened in response to light, but they didn't know what the steps were between the generation of IP3 and the opening of the channel. And now, recently, people have found that it's the lipid that carries the message.
So then the calcium score release is also run?
It's, I think the...
Will it still generate spikes in response to light just because of all the channels opening up and the positive feedback on the channels?
I'm pretty sure it would. I think now the view is that the calcium change that's associated with this acts as an adaptation message. that turns down the gain of the system. But that's right. So in other signaling systems, the releasing calcium then can cause calcium-induced calcium release from, so it actually opens calcium channels in the surface membrane. That makes an electrical signal and things move. So in the vertebrate system, now I'll draw the two main kinds of receptors. One are the rods, and the other are cones. And in both cases, the membrane is, in this case, it's highly infolded in the cone case. And in the rods, this part of the cell is packed with flattened membrane discs. And these membranes are packed in turn with the photopigment rhodopsin. Or in the case of cones, it's basically the same molecule, but the protein is a little bit different. So this gets into the question of how do we see colors. We have three different classes of cones that respond to blue, green, and red light. And the three classes have slightly, the protein that retinal sits in is slightly different. And it tunes the absorption of retinal to different wavelengths. So the electronic structure around the retinal tunes its peak absorption to either the blue part of the spectrum, the green part, or the red part. And in rods, we only have one kind of photopigment, and its peak sensitivity is in the green, and that's rhodopsin. So in both of these cell types, there's a standing current that circulates. And now I'm going to drop the discussion of the cones, but they basically work the same way. And they signal color because they're maximally activated by different colored lights. And so their signal goes.
Is the signal according to their position, or is it according to their neurotransmitter?
It's according to what they detect best. So they know that it's getting information. Oh, so that's hardwired into the retina.
So that's location, it's not signal.
That would be location, okay. That's right.
So
yeah.
No.
They all use the same neurotransmitters. Then they talk to different second. Yeah, okay. The peak is really the main thing that's tuned, but yeah, so you have a lot of problem there because the spectra are actually quite broad. So you could excite, for example, a red cone with a lot of light, and then you wouldn't know was that really red light or was it blue light that you gave me at a super high intensity. And you know that when you get into color vision, these kinds of things are, color is basically a calculation. And it's weighing, well, if you gave me a lot of blue light, what did I see on my blue channel compared to what I saw on the red and the green channels? How would I calculate what I think is the best calculation or solution for those different activations? So you can get into, there are all these incredibly interesting illusions for color vision that basically relate to this, yeah.
In animals where the third cone is recent, it's not optimally overlapping a lot with the other.
So you mean like if we looked at the spectra, are they more? I don't know that. I don't actually know the answer to that. I mean, other animals have maybe. I think turtles, for example, have five different cones. So they move into the UV, and they have a whole bunch of things also in the far red. So other kinds of animals have conceivably much richer color sense than we do.
What about colorblind people? What happens to them?
They have a mutation in the protein part of the photopigment, so it doesn't, it basically doesn't detect the, so it doesn't tune the retinal properly, so it doesn't see green light, for example, which is quite common. So it would just, it doesn't have the usual response to green light. This is meant to be just an hour, right? All right, I'll go quickly now. So the way the these photoreceptors work is there's a standing current that flows in darkness. There's a current flows into the outer segment, and it's carried by sodium and calcium. And then it flows out of the inner segment through potassium channels. So this is potassium. And this is a dark current that's flowing in darkness. And the way this is controlled, so then there are pumps that pump sodium out. These are ATP-driven pumps that pump sodium out and potassium back in. And this is sort of what Boris was talking about. And here's an example of where this is providing the energy for this kind of a circulating current. Calcium, which is the other important element here, is also removed by a kind of pump that uses the sodium gradient, so the energy in the sodium gradient, to pump calcium back out of the cell against its concentration gradient. So the concentration of sodium outside the cell might be 120 millimolar, and inside in this cell it might be 10 millimolar. So where do these gradients originally come from? Well, they're maintained by this pump. So the ATP pumps sodium out. Oh, so there would be a, I mean, the difference between the sodium gradient, the sodium concentration here and there would probably be minuscule. It would probably be only a few millimolar. The difference is, this is like 10 millimolar, and this is 120 millimolar. That's right. These channels are only found in the outer segment. Yeah, sorry. And the other messenger here is calcium, where here the intracellular concentration is like 500 nanomolar, and the external would be 1 millimolar. So there's a huge concentration gradient. There's also a charge gradient. So the inside of the cell is negative by maybe minus 40 millivolts. So both of these things are going to pull the positive charge sodium in, down a gradient, down a chemical and electrical gradient, and also true for the calcium. The potassium channel is sort of the workhorse of this. So the potassium concentration inside is going to be about 100 millimolar, and outside it's about 3 millimolar. So this has just the opposite concentration gradient. Okay. So this is running in darkness. And the channels that the current flows through are only in the outer segment. And there are channels that bind cyclic GMP to open. So in the dark, the cell has a lot of cyclic GMP. The channels are open. The cell has this dark current. It keeps the cell relatively depolarized because there's this constant influx of sodium. So the resting potential of this cell is probably sitting around 40 millivolts. The resting potential of most neurons and most other cells is down around minus 70, something like that, minus 80. So now when light activates rhodopsin, that turns on a G protein called transducin GT. And the activated G protein then turns on an enzyme called phosphodiesterase. And phosphodiesterase, when it's turned on, hydrolyzes cyclic GMP to GMP, and that inactivates it. So then these channels close. So that shuts off the influx of sodium and calcium. Potassium, though, continues to leave the cell because its equilibrium point would be down here somewhere. So the photoreceptor then hyperpolarizes.
What's the rate limiting step here?
The rate limiting step in the cascade? Well, I would guess, what's the slowest step, you say?
You can define time constants for all those various things. And they actually are all about comparable.
Yeah, I would say that's right.
Or, at least there are several of them that are comparable. And of course, there are many very fast processes, isomerization. And that's not sure anything can go.
So that, this thing is sort of backwards in that we normally think of, when we receive something that it actually activates something. But in the case of the photoreceptor, light is turning off events. It's turning off the flow of this current. This current had been keeping the cell depolarized, so there was lots of calcium in the terminal, and we were releasing transmitter steadily in the dark. Transmitter's glutamate. And then when it hyperpolarizes, that shuts off the influx of calcium out here and turns off the release of transmitter. So we see light in kind of a intuitively backward way. Well, I think of it as being backwards. I just, I think of all the other kinds of sensory receptors when they detect the thing they're designed to detect, they get turned on.
Well, it seems backwards if light was a blackboard. We saw white things, but we see dark things. It's a white all the time.
Oh, all right. Okay. But it's weird to think that at night, this thing is going at, full blast, so to speak. That's right, but your dark. If you'd let me work on your eye, I would record this vigorous dark current that's flowing, and you're eating up ATP to keep the gradients going. I've never heard a really good explanation. Some people think, well, it's a way of sort of distributing the metabolic cost, because in light, then you have to regenerate the photopigment, which I haven't talked about. And there are things associated with light that are also energy dependent. As we'll see in a moment, one of them is an important component of this story, and that is what happens to calcium during the light. So when we shut off the influx of calcium, this pump here continues to pump calcium down. And calcium then becomes a feedback messenger in this pathway. So light causes first a decrease in cyclic GMP, which then secondarily causes a decrease in calcium because the pump continues pumping calcium, so we get a decrease in calcium. Calcium then is detected by a calcium binding protein called GCAP. And GCAP, when it's bound to calcium, is inactive. And when it's calcium free, it's activated. And then GCAP, then when it's activated, turns on an enzyme called guanylyl cyclase, which synthesizes cyclic GMP from GTP. So now we've set into motion a series of events, which is bringing cyclic GMP back up again and helping the response recover. So we've turned on the enzyme that destroyed it, and now we've also turned on, as a feedback, we've turned on an enzyme that resynthesizes the messenger. Meanwhile, the elements in the cascade have turned themselves off or have been inactivated. So cyclic GMP levels come back and the photoreceptor returns to its resting dark state. Of course, you look, you have the knitted brow. You have a knitted brow. Okay. Yeah, I don't know what those flashes are. I don't know what they are. I'm around some infrared lasers, and I never had those flashes of light before working with Winfried. And now I have them all the time. So I wonder if it's not related to some kind of a damage or something. I don't know.
It is D-ish to me.
What?
To the extent that there's evidence that we're able to detect five photons or a few photons, right?
Right.
There are certainly spontaneous isolation events, so one can actually estimate the probability of
them occurring in
five events occurring spontaneously within 10th of a second. And there's something for you to look at. Yeah.
But those few photons have to be all absorbed within a certain area. I mean, we have.
So let's talk about, for that matter, single rod, right? So you can estimate the likelihood of having five spontaneous isomerization events in the 10th of a second single rod. Right?
It's very, very. That would, the probability would be nil.
Well, but then we also know that retina will integrate input from 1,000.
It's 10 times nil. maybe it's spontaneous events, but the flashes I see are when at night when I look, when I move my eye way off to the edge, and I don't know why.
They're really all bright flashes.
Yeah, they're very actually very disturbing.
You're making me feel more normal.
Well, we'll have to send you to Winfried's lab for a month. It's in the periphery, yeah.
Do you see the
moment?
No, we did.
You and I are special, that's what. The rest of these guys are just dullards. So, when you wake up tonight in the middle of the night and you're dark adapted, move your eye way over like that and see if you see anything. Well, I mean, I can keep going, but I think this is feedback. Right.
That's sort of a general principle that you can use like cycles and so forth, that you want to provide lots of amplification very fast.
You have something that's going.
Some sort of energy consumption, like, you know, going on. I mean, you can, you know, your TV set so that it turns on the moment you turn the power on, you've been consuming energy all the time even when you didn't have it on.
I see.
Right? Or your amplifier. It's a great one.
Thank you.
What is the general principle? I don't know that there's a general theorem. I don't know a general theorem. There's a general principle in technology that you want to be able to react very fast to something. You need to start being consuming energy in some way, because if your power is going to be limited in some way, you know, you won't have enough power fast to be able to react and create large amplification. So you need to charge your capacitors to have things sort of.
Yeah, the
no, sort of trigger happy, right?
The problem with explaining this dark before the dark current in the
and they don't get a very high amplification very fast.
No, they don't. That's right. Yeah.
Sorry, but do they do high level amplification very fast?
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the question, right?
They're the fastest photoreceptors of the flies.
But the amount of amplification very high?
It's probably not as high as this, but it's significant.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
If you want to have lots of amplification, right? You need to somehow consume a lot of power very fast, and you can't do that because your power source. I mean, it's one explanation, I'm not saying.
Yeah.
But you certainly see it in technology all
the time. Yeah, the hair cells run off of a dark current, continuous current too. They're the receptors in the ear. So
well,
there are
certainly the cochlear model is based on off-site location. Those are all based on the ear connected. Definitely. And in fact, you have those diseases where you can hear people ear.
Yeah, that's a slightly different issue though. I mean, the hair cells themselves have a current that's flowing through them in their resting state.
Okay.
And you modulate, you either increase or decrease that. The sound pressure either increases or decreases that.
That's not, we're not talking about the Julie Schert type model.
No. The one you're talking about, the inner hair cells, where they contract, and they do a mechano, I guess they run mechano transduction in the reverse direction. Right, that's right. No, that's true. Yeah, the same system for cones. The only difference is in their morphologies are different, and their wavelength tuning is different.
Yeah,
spiking or on during the day?
Oh, on.
So they don't, they're all graded. Yeah. Well, I think right now they're off. I mean, I think they're seeing enough light that they're saturated. They are. I mean, that's a good. The fly neurons. They're probably working fine. Yeah. I don't. But our. Maybe, and I don't know why that would. I don't know enough about flies, really. But I think in us, I think our rods are, the light levels are too high. They kind of go out of the picture when the light gets much brighter than strong moonlight. Maybe. You're working off your cones, yeah. Yeah. I mean, they adapt very well, almost completely. So they're fine.
So this whole discussion was specifically about rods, right?
Well, in general, it also applies to cones. I mean, they have the same cascade, they have the same arrangement of dark current and everything.
But they also consume that much current when not used?
I would think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, but maybe they are. I don't. They're clearly on, right? I mean, because we can see quite well, and you know, we're not. We would still be able to see if we were out on the beach or where the light levels are enormous.
Is fly pigeon able to adapt?
Yes. Mm-hmm. To the steady light levels. Yeah, it is. No, that's right. No, it's. I guess all sensory systems would adapt, and the mechanisms of adaptation between the invertebrates and the vertebrate are clearly different, and not understood in either case in detail. Thank you.